We are going to talk about dynamic risk management. Do you have me for it? Russ.
Thank you, Hans. Today we will be discussing papers 4B and 4C. Paper 4A has been provided for information purposes. Paper 4B, certain strategies and the target profile. In this paper, the staff discussed certain qualifying criteria for the DRM model. Paragraphs 4 through 18 explain why the DRM model should and does provide flexibility in defining the target profile. These paragraphs also discuss the existing restriction on leverage as previously tentatively decided. Paragraphs 19 through 23 highlight another way leverage can be introduced to the target profile, i.e. through including negative balances in the target profile. For the reasons mentioned in paragraph 24, the staff are of the preliminary view that defining the target profile with a negative balance should be prohibited because it implies leverage. Said differently, individual time buckets in the target profile cannot be defined with a negative balance. Before asking question one, I would clarify that this is a qualifying criterion focused on the definition of the target profile. If in the normal course of operations an entity finds itself overhedged and consequently with a negative balance in a time bucket through the combination of the asset profile and the designated derivatives, this does not disqualify the model. The overhedge must simply be measured and reported in line with the decisions made on imperfect alignment. With that, I'll ask question number one. Does the board agree that negative balance within the target profile should not be permitted?
Question.
Amaro.
That's a question. Read the papers. Well written, very direct paper. And particularly paragraph 17, I think it drives me to a positive answer, or in other sense, agree with you, because I think if I don't agree, we would have to revisit the whole of the model. Is that your sense?
I'm not sure we'd have to revisit the entire model, but
the basis.
I think we're trying to take the concept we discussed back in March and say, discuss that on the total level. We need to think about that at the individual level as well.
Okay. Thank you.
No further comments? Do we agree with that recommendation?
All in favor?
Yeah.
Paragraphs 26 through 31, the staff discuss changes in strategy and recommend that in order for the model to provide useful information, changes in strategy must occur infrequently. In addition, the staff recommend that the risk management strategy must be clearly documented and cannot be contingent in nature, as this would make it difficult to understand if a change in strategy has occurred. And with that, I'll ask question two. Does the board agree that changes to the risk management strategy must occur infrequently, and that the strategy must be clearly documented and cannot be defined in a way that is contingent?
I think I agree with your sentiment. I just had a question on, or a comment on the wording and an observation, I guess. So the way that 31A is expressed, it sounds like we're telling people that they're not allowed to do particular things from a risk management perspective, and I can imagine they'll say, this is an accounting standard, you can't tell me what to do from a risk management perspective. So do we mean that you can no longer apply this approach if they sort of do this? So if they flip-flop around too much, we're saying you don't qualify anymore, as opposed to we're saying you're not allowed to do this from a risk management perspective? Is that what we mean?
The model should discontinue perspective.
Yeah. So I think we need to be more specific with our wording. And given the importance of that and the severity of that consequence, words like infrequently are a little bit tricky in terms of, you know, how infrequent, frequent, or, you know, in terms, because it's a pretty severe consequence. So I don't have a better suggestion, but maybe that's just something to test when we go out. But in the first instance, I think we need to re-express 31A as, in order to continue to apply this model, then you have to not have the.
I was not surprised to see this. I thought it continued from what you've alluded to before to us, that we wouldn't be expecting the risk management strategy to be changing, and I think you said the words flip-flopping, so we're not expecting that. So in terms of seeing this, I'm not surprised to see this come through, and I think it is very much a part of the model. I did pause over the word infrequently, like Sue, but I think that it is your intention, I understand, to explain and give some examples of the types of events that may cause people to change their risk management strategy, and they could be large macroeconomic type events. It might be a change of senior management and different things. So I'm happy that you're going to put some context around infrequently. And then in part B, I thought about the, so clearly documented, yes, we've mentioned that, the specified time horizon. Well, I think the model doesn't work without a time horizon, so I expected that. And then I saw the word contingent, and that was new for me, but I understand that to be writing a strategy that's got contingencies within it that then allow change within the strategy. So once that was explained, I'm also happy with the word contingent. So perhaps in summary, like Sue, I'll be looking forward to how that gets worded. Thank you.
Mary?
Wording communication point rather than disagreement with it. I think these are appropriate in light of what we've discussed and what our intention is. Adding on to the comments that Sue and Anne have made, I think it would be helpful to stand when we're talking about this, not just to set it out as we have requirements for you to use this model because we're mean or because we're extracting a pound of flesh. It's in, you know, explaining why in order for the model to work, there have to be certain disciplines, and then putting these requirements in the context of how they deliver those minimum necessary requirements. I think also thinking about infrequent, it's not just about how often is infrequent, but I think it might be helpful to pick up some of the material you covered with us at the very beginning of this project in terms of how committed is an entity to a risk management strategy. Is it, you know, when I was coming in this morning, I was listening to the news and heard about X and I changed it. Now, you know, it's not that. It's something that goes through pretty significant process and commitment from an organization. And it may be up to management to execute, but my sense is that it's something that is reviewed and overseen by normally some kind of committee of the board.
Amaru.
Excellent. Just try to be constructive on the language here, because I also, my reaction to those two proposals was much more, I do agree with the direction. It's much more the language on 31A, I really felt must occur very strong, or maybe far too strong. So in my mind, it was could be something like not expected to occur frequently, or expected to occur infrequently. Doesn't matter, huh? Something like that. I think this is the idea. It's not really to close, but we don't. So we must occur. I think it's too much. On 31B, two things. Being must be clearly documented. So maybe I'm too much on the rules based when I think about clearly documented, because clearly documented, it's a principle, and I felt a little bit what is exactly we expect to see as clearly documented. Is clearly documented and approved by the appropriate level of senior management. I can't say always that's very senior because I think I missed a little bit here. I know the principle, the objective, but clearly documented could be a sheet of paper prepared by the manager or what we do expect here. I think we expect something really senior level. This is a strategy. This is not really reaction to a week of volatility or something like that. So I think I would expect, since I wouldn't expect it to occur frequently, I think the approval process that would lead to a proper documented strategy would be in a higher level.
Gary?
Thank you. looking at, I agree with the staff's plenary view, but I might just ask a question. How do you operationalize this thing? You start off, you have an asset profile, which are actuals. So I'll just ask this in terms of a hypothetical, just to see how the risk strategy would change. Let's say you're a standard commercial bank, you know, with a portfolio of the usual lending products. But over time, the business strategy changes. You want to go become more of an investment bank or a merchant bank or industrial financing, where the tenor of your assets are different, the lending rates and collaterals are very different. Does this strategy, does your risk management strategy contemplate major changes in the strategy? And it might take years to get there, where it's evolutionary as your commercial lending portfolio winds down, you start investing into something else. So yes, they're all still interest-bearing assets of some sort. They all got financing of some sort. Does your target profile or the recommendations here accommodate that, or do those become examples of change? Again, back to nothing stays constant, and your business goals may very well change, but they'll evolve as opposed to changing tomorrow.
Yeah, and the short answer is maybe, in terms of how would a strategy actually fit within the context of risk management as we've defined it versus someone moving from a kind of a commercial lending operation to an investment bank. That probably pushes the boundary where this model would apply in an investment bank. It's a trading type operation. But if someone's changing the type of loans that they're engaged with, and so that the tenor and term of those loans might be different, if there's no change to the entity's kind of funding, I would expect their strategy to be changing. If you're moving from a primarily 2 to 3 year type duration to a 10-year type duration loan book, I would think your strategy would have to think about that. So yes, I would think that type of move would be contemplated as a change in strategy.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm fine when there's a strategic change in the business, your target profile for your risk strategy can change. And we should accommodate that. It's when, gee, I'm just taking a situational advantage of market rates or arbitrage or opportunities, or I increase it, decrease it, accelerate it, or whatever. That's what we're trying to avoid here, but it's not just a fundamental change in the tenor and types of lending that you're doing.
Correct. Correct.
Thank you.
Councilor Eisen.
Yes, like others, I mean, I support what you're trying to achieve. In addition to the comments that you've already received on wording, I would add that I don't think that we should formulate it as a risk management that should not be contingent. I think that in the event of a contingency, this should be analyzed as being a change, rather, because they're right there, their risk management strategy in the way they wish. But if a contingency arises, that is akin to a change in strategy. I have reservations about the frequency, so I would join with the comments that you've already received. I think to me what is very important is both the level at which the decision is made, but also what prompts the change. So you mentioned yourself a product mix that would change, maybe a macroeconomic change. It may be the result of a periodic assessment of how effective the risk management strategy is. To me, all these kind of changes would be valid to continue applying the model, and they would not be expected to occur frequently indeed. But because of their nature, rather than having to refer to a form of passage of time that remains indefinite. Not indefinite, indeterminate. That's the problem with English.
Can I ask the staff a question? Because I think what I'm trying to work out is, are we worried that that people might change the strategy in a way that's trying to achieve an accounting outcome? So there might be a sort of objective that we don't agree with. So the reason for why the change has happened matter to us. or are we trying to be clear about, when we talk about strategy, how high level a decision it is versus sort of how implementation level the decision is? Because in IFRS 9, for example, we've got this distinction between, you know, I can't remember what the words are we use, strategy or objectives, that are sort of a long-term strategy, and then you've got execution that goes on below, which doesn't disturb that. Because I'm just, when we're drafting this, are we trying to eliminate particular types of behaviour? Are there particular types of changes that we think are okay? Because if it's to do with the amount of variation, which means then the mechanics don't work terribly well and the information content is different, I sort of understand that versus avoidance. So at 30,000 feet, what are we trying to focus on with this?
I don't think we're necessarily trying to prevent an accounting outcome, because I think we've already provided rules that make sure that the accounting outcome from a change would make sense. So I think part of it is that if the change is just happening constantly, I think mechanically there's a problem, because I think the information gets jumbled, but then I start to question how committed the entity is to the strategy. And therefore, if we're trying to show the effects of a long-term strategy, but you're changing it every day, then okay, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But I do think frequency is important there, but I think there is a valid comment about the rationale for why the decision is being made. Just because there was a very good reason to change the strategy yesterday, and then another massive piece of information has come in tomorrow, that might mean a very good reason to rethink the strategy. I'm being obviously extreme, but
I'm not asking you because I necessarily disagree or agree. I just, based on my experience in the past doing outreach on hedge accounting, if there's a perception that we're starting to sort of start to make observations on which sort of activities we think are appropriate or not, I know how people are going to react. So I think we're going to have to be able to articulate quite clearly what it is we're focusing on and what our motivation is.
Can I just give it a shot? Sorry, Martin was there.
Yeah, man, I think it is a kind of what you want to achieve is, because, man, we allowing people can apply this model, okay, to have derivatives, market value moves in OCI. And if we, I think, but we allowing target profiles which can include a certain expectation how interest markets will be developed and therefore positioning themselves. And I think if we would allow, for example, to daily adjusting that, is that different from trading? Where we have then the derivatives, I think, requiring full fair value mark to market through P&L. And I think, for me, that is the overall perspective, because I think if we're allowing that too frequent, then the accounting model which we have here is not representing what we think, okay, is a business model then.
Exactly.
That is my understanding why we...
Can I just add one thing? Yes, absolutely. It's no different from what the concepts we have today. So when we have a business model change or anything, what is a potential or highly probable forecast transaction, it disqualifies you going forward, because that's the strategy is no longer what the model was trying to accommodate. So it's almost akin to a trading strategy. So the accounting is not giving the information, as you said. The other bit, which is the second part, is B, is that clearly documented with a specific time horizon. And as Francois said, we can say if the time horizon keeps changing, it becomes a change in strategy. The reason for that, for the specific time horizon, is also important, because remember, the recycling of the model is over the time horizon. We don't want people to start playing around with the time horizon, because that's indirectly will achieve the same effect that we are trying to prevent with the first one. That's a key accounting peg, because we recycle the OCI balance over the time horizon of the target profile.
To the way Sue asked the question, does that imply that we are thinking that if an entity is changing its approach on a regular basis, it's probably a risk management tactic rather than a risk management strategy? And so we're trying to use this infrequent word to suggest that you need to go up the pole a little bit higher to get to the right space.
Yeah, it seems like, before anything, that seems like if you're changing your strategy every day, that seems more like a trading strategy, yep, rather than something where you're trying to balance or manage your net interest margin. So you're trying to make gains or losses by trading rather than something that should be represented through accrued interest.
Sort of talks, and I think Gary touched, sort of talks on where the decision-making is actually happening. If the decision-making is happening at an operational level, that's probably not the risk management strategy we're targeting. What we're thinking about is the risk management committee or the subcommittee of the board or whatever, that level where there isn't the level of intervention at a regular enough basis to be infrequent.
Or to be frequent.
To be frequent, yeah.
Because trying as a student to answer Sue's question, I think what the way I'm thinking about this is we've been told that there's a problem when an AP has a long-term strategy, but because the components of what are being managed under that component under that long-term strategy are changing regularly, hence dynamic and dynamic risk management, that it needs a special accounting model. And I think what we're trying to get to are the characteristics that qualify for the problem we're trying to solve, and it, you know, as well as also being some discipline disciplinary items. But if it's a strategy that's changing every day, then it isn't a long-term strategy with daily tuning. It's a short-term strategy, and it's more like trading. So I think we need to explain this, and I think it relates back to what is the problem we're trying to solve in the first instance. And then the requirements for application of the model flow from that.
Okay.
Can we get a
vote? Supports the staff recommendation?
All in favor?
14. Okay. Moving on to paper 4C. In this paper, the staff discuss how derivatives designated in the DRM model should be presented in financial reporting, and more specifically focuses on disaggregation and whether there is merit in individual line items. Starting with the statement of financial position, in paragraphs 9 through 19, the staff discuss if the designated derivatives should have their own lines in the statement of financial position because their nature is different to derivatives not designated in the DRM accounting model. However, as highlighted in paragraphs 12 and 19, IFRS standards have already considered a similar question and have concluded that disclosure is enough in this regard. Paragraphs 20 through 24, the staff consider a similar question but focused on the amounts in other comprehensive income. The staff are recommending the DRM model be consistent with the existing requirements of IFRS standards for the reasons stated in paragraphs 19 and 24. However, before I ask the questions to the board, the staff would like to remind the board that the recommendations are in the context of the core model, i.e. to focus on the most important aspects of DRM and develop materials for outreach and discussion to inform future decisions. With that, I'll ask questions 1 and 2 concurrently. Does the board agree that disaggregation of designated derivatives would provide useful information to users of financial reporting, and the DRM model should communicate this information through disclosure rather than a separate line item in the statement of financial position? Does the board agree that the DRM accounting model should not require presentation of accumulated changes in fair value of the designated derivatives in a separate line item within other comprehensive income, but this information should be clearly communicated to users through disclosure?
Daryl.
So I think, and I understand where you've come from with the way it's been applied in other circumstances. I understand why we made those decisions. I think in the context of banking books, this is typically a very big number. At the very least, it's a very volatile number that moves around a lot on the balance sheet. And to my mind, this has a very significantly different creates a very different perception to what you would create if you're looking at derivatives that are on the book for trading purposes or for client purposes and other reasons. So I did not agree with the reason for excluding it, assuming for the moment that it's material, because obviously that applies to everything. So my view is in both cases, I think this is a big enough, important enough number, and we'll get to the sort of flow through in terms of the other decisions. But I think this is something that I would see as better disclosed separately or report disaggregated on the balance sheet and in OCI.
Françoise.
My comments are consistent with what Daryl just said. When I look at the paragraph of IS1 that you referred to, the focus of the paragraph is on their nature of function. And because they would have a different nature of function that would have a different measurement basis, the fact that they have the same measurement basis does not, for me, lead to the conclusion to which it has led you. To me, I go back and say these have different functions. So I would I would suspect that exactly as Darrell said, that this is important enough as part of the business model of those entities to be have a higher focus than just in disclosures. And it is certainly something that I would like users' input before reaching a final conclusion.
Chen Chao.
Thank you. When I look at this issue, I think the staff agree that those information should be disaggregated, but whether it should be on the face of the financial statement or in the notes with, through the disclosure. So I think whether we need a line item to disclose those information. I'm thinking because if we look at the decision made with regard to primary financial statement, we did propose the disaggregation principle there, and the principle is that those items, if they have similar characteristics, they can combined together. If the characteristic is not similar, they should be disclosed as a separate line item. And what kind of characteristics should be considered? And we also develop some kind of guidance on the nature, function, or measurement, basically something like this. So even based on our suggestion, I think the reason behind this, it seems that the paragraph 16, we say that the nature and of the function of those derivatives are all different. If they are all different, I think they should not be included in separate, in one line item. They should be separately disclosed even on the face. But from my point, I think that maybe not the case. I think those derivatives, if you look at the nature, actually they are the same, but the function is different. So whether, because they are derivatives, you know, the nature is, but they play a different role play a different function with regard to the dynamic risk management activities. So in this regard, I'm struggling that because you agree with disaggregating those information, but whether if the nature is the same, in my understanding, the nature is the same of all those direct derivatives, but the function is different, whether they should be included in the same line item or should be disclosed in the notes.
Martin?
I agree with the recommendation because I think this kind of information provides only, I think, useful information in the context of other information where you use hedge accounting. And I think Sedis' staff proposal, okay, that we have a, I think, comprehensive disclosure of the derivatives and the target profile and all these kind of issues. And that would provide, I think, users with useful information. But if you have it separate on the balance sheet or P&L, I don't know what kind of users would do with this information. I don't have any idea. But if people think it is important, I don't know why.
Sue?
So I think there's sort of two pieces to both of these questions. And the first is whether we think that these particular, well, I think we're asking whether these particular derivatives should be, information should be provided about them separately. And then there's a sort of second question for me, which is where. And on the first question, I just wanted to confirm. So companies have already got other derivatives that they've designated for hedge accounting purposes using hedge accounting as currently exists on IFRS 9. Are we suggesting, or is the staff recommending that there be separate presentation for the derivatives designated as part of the DRM model that's separate from derivatives designated under IFRS 9?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. It wasn't clear to me because we flip-flop in terms of our terminology. So firstly, I agree with separating it out as DRM-related hedging derivatives, for want of a better word. I'm not so convinced that it needs to be on the face, so I would agree with the staff recommendation because I think, like Martin, I think that it's probably most useful for investors in the context of other information about what's going on So I'd be happy to go with the staff recommendation. Although if we, whatever we end up with special requests, I think we're trying to be disciplined, and where we're talking about presentation to always say presented on the face, and when we talk about disclosure to always say disclosure in the notes.
Sure.
So whatever we vote on an update, can we make sure we're specific about placement as well as using those words?
Yep.
Gary?
Yeah, I agree with the staff recommendations largely for the same reasons Martin and Sue. I mean, I think of the balance sheet of P&L as a structured summary of things. And at some point, you could overload them with information, too. And we've got a lot of information, whether it's required by 7 or 13 or 9, or this, on financial instruments in general. Notes are loaded with them. I think this belongs in there. And as you point out, there's one-on-one derivatives that are individually designated and portfolio designations like this. I mean, where does it end? I think if companies wish to put it on the face of the balance sheet, we certainly wouldn't prohibit it. The issue is, do we require it? I don't think it's necessary to require. And the minute you start requiring something that's otherwise better handled in the note, then you get into issues of rights of offset and counterparty risk. And what if you've got both payables and receivable positions with the same counterparty? Those are the second-level questions that probably come to the fore that I don't think we need to deal with in this project.
Just quickly, one of the things I think with the proposals and what Martin, Gary, Sue said, the information will be there. It's a point of emphasis. It will not be on the face. It will be in the notes. And these are, will, if we complete, the disclosures and other things will not be simple. So it's a matter of not, it's not a question of the users not having the information. It's a question of how much emphasis we put on that information. Yeah.
Just quick clarification just on what Gary said. So when you're putting this in, you're not prohibiting, you're requiring disclosure, but they have the option of presenting?
We didn't intend to prohibit.
Okay, so if that's the case, I think I totally agree with what Gary and Martin said, is the notes probably for the bulk of them, and if somebody really thinks it's material and helpful, they can put it on the face.
So either the face or the notes.
And, either on the face or the notes.
And I had also wanted just to confirm that point, because the drafting in question one, although not the drafting in question two, is written in such a way that it precludes presentation on the face, even if an entity wanted to. So again, I think in terms of what we are voting on and what we report, we should, from what you just said, I think we should assume the type of wording that's in question two shall not require presentation, as opposed to what you said should communicate through disclosure. That's, you know, the wording in question one. So, okay.
Yeah. You meant to say that.
Yeah. With that explanation, can we report staff recommendation?
Wait.
12.
12 in favor.
Okay. Moving on to the income statements, actually in the profit or loss, and starting with the aligned portion, which is discussed in paragraphs 26 through 45. In these paragraphs, the staff argue that the aligned portion as an amount has information content that should be communicated separately to users of financial reporting. If the board agrees with this, then the question that naturally arises is where and how to communicate that information. The staff think that since the objective of DRM, as discussed throughout the project, is to manage the net of interest revenue and expense, there is a strong link between the aligned portion and interest revenue and interest expense. To separate these three components would ignore the linked nature and, in the eyes of the staff, would not provide useful information. Therefore, the staff think that wherever we decide to separately communicate the aligned portion, the face, or in the notes, it must be done in a way that makes it clear the three components are related. In this paper, the staff discussed the concept of related using the language from paragraph 29 and provide a recommendation in paragraph 34. Finally, the staff considered if the aligned portion should have its own line item. For the reasons discussed in paragraphs 36 through 40, the staff are of the view that it should, because the aligned portion is not really interest revenue, nor is it interest expense. And therefore, to include it in either could arguably distort the meaning of those lines themselves. Such a recommendation would be consistent with the rationale in IFRS 9, paragraph B6615, and the 2014 DRM discussion paper. Having said that, the staff acknowledged that additional line items could overburden a statement that is intended to have some level of aggregation in the first place, and as such, think this question should be considered during outreach. With that, I'll ask the board if they agree with the staff recommendations on the aligned portion. More specifically, the information about the aligned portion should be communicated separately to users. It should be communicated in a way that makes it clear it is related to interest revenue and expense, that the aligned portion have its own line item on the face of the income statement, and that the question of face versus disclosure be considered during outreach.
And I agree with staff recommendation. And the first question is a no-brainer, because we're doing that to a stabilized interest margin, and then not to show it in interest margin, I think would be failed our objective. Therefore, I agree. Secondly, I think there are pros and cons, because clearly we need this information separately, what it is, but where? Because many people maybe want to calculate all the kind of average interest margin looking at the volumes of the cash balances of financial instruments, and if then we include that, I think they come up with a wrong number. And therefore, I think there are pros and cons, and we should clearly ask people in outreach, okay, what they think about that.
Sue?
I agree with the spirit of where you get.
That's a start.
And so I agree that. So in terms of what people are required to do today, as I understand it, we require them to have interest revenue presented separately on the face, and we require them to have finance cost separately on the face. Net interest margin, income, whatever, is commonly used in the market, but it's not actually an IFRS thing, so I don't think we can require anything particular about it, because it sort of doesn't exist for us, even though it's market practice. They already have to have the interest revenue. They have to have finance cost, at least. We know that often they show interest expense. I would agree that it makes sense to show this aligned portion as a separate piece of information. And on the face of it, given how important everybody, all the banks tell us it is, it seems to follow that it would make sense to have it on the face of the income statement. So I'd agree with that. I don't think we can require it to be in net interest income, because it's not a thing for us. And in the past, for example, when something's come to the Interpretations Committee on this, they very quickly reminded us we couldn't actually specify what was in that subtotal, because it's not our subtotal. It does mean that we've got a different sort of situation to what we have, as I understand it, of something subject to a IFRS 9 sort of specific micro hedge, where it actually adjusts the interest revenue or expense line. But I think there's reasons for that, because it's sort of dealing with the net position as opposed to the separate position, so I think that makes sense.
IFRS 9 is very particular about that. If you have a micro, you adjust the line item. If you have a net position hedge with offsetting risk positions, you can't do that, because you don't know exactly, for the same reasons, which line item to put it in, and that's B6.15, and very critically 6.16, which actually talks about a net position interest rate hedge, but in a fair value context, because that comes into the allocation thing. So they said it has to be in a separate line item. So that's the concept which we have used out here, and we agree, because where do I put it? Because it's a bridge between interest revenue and interest expense. But yes, we don't have that subtotal.
So. So I'd agree with it being separately presented. I'd agree that asking people to provide information in a way that shows the relationship between the interest revenue and interest expense in this item would be helpful for users of financial statements. So I agree with all of that. The thing that this does make me ponder, though, is the fact that we know that we've got a big issue in terms of comparability with these net interest metrics in the market at the moment. We've had feedback on that in the past as part of the PFS project. And as part of the PFS project, we made a conscious decision to sort of limit the amount of work we're going to do that's financial institution specific in the confines of that project. But it does strike me as a little bit odd that we're putting all of this time and energy and effort into this project to try and get better information about net interest, and then we actually don't have any specific requirements. So we know, for example, that people put all sorts of different stuff in the scope of this. We know that people calculate it differently. A number of people use you know, take apart fair value remeasurements and take cash that's out and stick them in these line items and things. So personally, I wonder whether we should ask the staff to bring a paper to another meeting with the pros and cons of whether we do something bigger around the net interest metric, separate to this decision about the aligned portion. Now, I'm not sure that we should, because it's a, you can see Martin reacting already, because it's a bigger deal and it's not going to be too difficult, but it seems odd to me to spend all of these hours of time and effort in trying to make information about net interest better when the actual existing components of it are made up of goodness only knows what, because it's not something we opine on.
Can I just...
Yeah, my only, and I agree what Sue has said, but I really think we should not do that now. We should first maybe do this outreach, what we have agreed about the principles of the model, and then maybe this, because I think it is a lot of work if you really want to solve that. And I think if we trying to do that also on top of this project, I think we extending it even longer, and we already working years on that. And
I hear you, but also on the other hand, I feel like we're doing a perfect paint job on a house that's got no foundations, that's going to fall down next week. I mean,
I would not think it is so bad, because man, I really think not. And if you have the only difference is you report clean or dirty fair value, is what I think. That is a main issue.
There's all sorts of different things in scope. There's all different ways that interest is calculated. There's all different ways that people take derivatives and slice and dice them. There's so much variability in practice out there.
Yeah, but it's a different project, I think.
Harry?
I struggled a bit reaching a conclusion on the back of this paper, because I felt like there were some very helpful tools that we developed in the PFS project that we didn't really walk through. Now, I'm being lazy because I'm used to having the staff do all the heavy, you know, the heavy lifting of, you know, going across projects and picking up and thinking through it. My personal effort at doing that, and I'm thinking this is maybe some of what Jing Zhao was referring to before, the guidelines that we have for aggregation and disaggregation that we've developed that I think are very useful tools, would say, I'm going to jump to your question four answering this, which is, I think we would have to require this to be the aligned piece in a separate line item, because by nature it's the change in fair value of a derivative. It is not interest income and it is not interest expense. So I think the guidelines that we have been articulating would say you cannot aggregate the change in fair value and call it interest, because it blows the faithful representation and it blows the different nature. And I'm saying aggregated in a single line item. Now, I think that's reinforced by the very helpful analysis that you've done in, for example, paragraph 37, that shows why, you know, what the problems would be of putting it all against revenue and all against expense. Sorry, I don't want to break the speakers. I think it is helpful to work through those other things when we've got a project like this that we're working on at the same time, as opposed to saying, let's start making changes for decisions we've reached in an ongoing project and apply them retrospectively to existing requirements that we might have in IFRS 9 or IAS 39. I think that's a different question. But we've been developing those requirements in PFS, and I think that they're very helpful. And I mean, just this morning we were talking about what does the P&L of a financial institution look like. And I think I've managed to knit the two discussions together, but I think in future it would be helpful to see it pulled together in the paper where we're considering it. So and because of that, when it comes to your question five, well, of course, when we consult on everything. We don't say that's off limits, or, you know, we made a decision but we're not consulting. But I don't want to send a signal that this is the softer decision than any of the others that we reach, because I think actually this is the one that other decisions we've made in other projects would drive us to most firmly. maybe even more so than the items that you were asking us about in questions one and two. So when you come to the questions, and Ross, I tweaked that you were paraphrasing them slightly when you did the tee up. I agree that the whole purpose of this project is to look at the relationship of this dynamic risk management activity to the management of interest revenue and interest expense. And so I see that it makes sense that we should say it should be presented as part of that presentation, but I don't think we can specify for the reasons Sue laid out in net interest margin. Question four, I think it's necessary for us to say it must be presented separately. And I think question five is one we shouldn't be asking because we're consulting on everything in the model, not just this.
Oh, Martin.
I mean, I have to say something to say. It's mine.
So I have to let you in. That's the
that
question.
Is true what you said. If our disaggregation project in PFS then would request that financial instruments which are fair value through the OCI, then the interest income could not be in the same line item as okay for others, I think.
We require it.
No, because fair value
is calculated using the effective interest method.
Yes.
It's a specific requirement.
But can I just to clarify, Mary, the point you were saying is for the hedges where we're saying
we're using the effective interest for this portion, right? For debt instruments which are fair value through OCI.
Yeah, and that goes through interest revenue. It's things that are fair value exactly. through P&L where they don't do those calculations.
But they're measured they're measured at amortized cost in the P&L.
Yep.
Yeah, here also.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's derivatives also. Amortized cost through the P&L and then the remaining part
No.
Is then
The fair value OCI, the instrument itself, not the hedging instrument, the instrument itself is measured at the hedged item is measured at amortized cost in the P&L. In this instance, we're talking about the aligned portion of the derivative, and it's trying to pull out the hypothetical interest portion of the derivative and label it as if it were interest.
I would only to say that is current practice in banks, and many people do instead for IAS 39 hedges and 9 hedges.
Right. Can I just,
and we should make clear if we meaning by the disaggregation project that we should not allowing that any further, because then we have to.
But that's why I was distinguishing.
Can I just come back?
And the agenda decision of the Interpretations Committee, they said explicitly there has to be an interest revenue line item for things measured at amortized cost and fair value OCI brackets, including the effects of hedge accounting. So it's already covered.
For micro hedges, the one you're talking about.
I mean, here is we don't. Yeah, I don't understand this.
So for one is to one.
Because we're allowing that, but here we will not allow that.
Well, the point I was just coming to what Mary said, I don't agree. Disagree with you, Mary, what we are saying. And also, I would say IFRS 9.
Line item.
Separate line item. That's got to be. But what Martin is coming to is that IFRS has also required you to recycle a cash flow hedge, which is 1:1, into the line item which it is hedging. So there, if it's an interest rate risk hedge, as we clarified in the IFRIC decision, you put that in the line item. I don't think those are the ones you had in mind.
That was the distinction I was trying to make between when we're in this project, when we're starting with a clean sheet of paper and developing a model for it, I think we have to think and apply the work that we are doing in a parallel project that's directly applicable to this issue. I'm not trying to accelerate the applicability of something we have not finalized and say it should also immediately be applied to IFRS 9 or IAS 39 hedging and start making changes there. So my comments about taking that thinking were limited to the DRM project.
That's what I was trying to do. You're not talking about 1:1 hedging. You're only talking about these hedges. Yeah. Nick?
Thank you. The first thing I've mentioned this to staff already, I think we need to be careful with terminology here. Certainly within investment markets, what we present here as net interest margin is commonly understood to be net interest income, and a net interest margin would be that net interest income over average earning assets. And indeed, if you put that into the internet, that's what the first five searches come back and tell you exactly that. So this to me looks slightly confusing just at face value, so just as we go forward. I certainly agree with the recommendation that the aligned portion should be presented as a separate item. I can't see how it could be otherwise. And I understand that we can't stipulate that it goes with these other items because we don't define them necessarily. But if I think about what users want to do with this data, they will want to calculate a net interest margin, both pre and post the effects of DRM. So at least in terms of our examples, I would suggest we put the aligned portion at the bottom of the three items. It just feels more logical in that sense. And then in terms of, I accept we do, there is a definition issue here around net interest income, but I also remember very well Martin telling us in previous board meetings his endeavours to resolve this in Germany and actually not actually getting anywhere, I think, in the end with it. Perhaps we do some preliminary investigations, but I suggest it's something to put up to the next agenda consultation. It could be quite a significant project.
Darrell?
So I think I agree with pretty much everything Sue said, and Nick, pretty much everything you said in terms of separate disclosure. Separate presentation presented, and Ross, I like the way you worded it, in the same sort of vicinity as these other things. to Sue's point about it's general practice, or it's practice to do it this way, I agree it is practice, but it's not universal practice.
No, it's not.
It's very easy to find examples of banks that don't have net interest margin, don't have net interest income. They've added other things together. So I think we have to be cautious in terms of the wording that we use. I hadn't thought about Sue's idea beforehand about us incorporating this into this project, the definition of interest income and interest expense into this project, or into the PFS project, or into a separate project. I guess the advantage of doing it in this one is that we would tie it to only those entities that were applying DRM, and we wouldn't have to think about how we applied banks, how we defined banks, or how we defined an entity for which this number, net interest margin, is an important number. But I have probably Martin's caution about whether we're going to end up going down a path that's going to extend further a timetable that's already been quite long. So I'd be very cautious about doing that as part of this project, at least.
First of all, I would like to agree to the staff recommendation. And on the face of the income statement, to me, this should encompass all the hedging activities that concur to the interest rate risk management strategy. Some being through the DRM, some being through micro hedges. So on the face, and then further disaggregation in the notes, but on the face of the income statement, you know, to encompass the two. Now to the wider issue of how we, what efforts we make in order to better harmonize the presentation of those activities above operating profit. I mean, we deliberately, in the presentation financial statements project, limited the guidance above operating profit to being the choice between nature and function. And that was deliberate in order to not delay for a specific set of entities, a specific problem, the whole benefit that can be derived more generally of that project. And I would remain supportive of the decision that we've made. Now, whether I was wrong or right, I was expecting, in fact, and I wonder whether it was not suggested at the time, in fact, this agenda decision at the IFRS committee was decided, that the DRM project might be a place where we could put some efforts into bringing better comparability in the presentation of those elements. I'm not suggesting that at this stage of the project the staff would do any further work on this, but my understanding is that we are just finalizing the core model, and the core model next step is a stakeholder outreach dedicated to meeting people that have a direct interest in this, so they have also direct knowledge. Whether they are users, they know what they suffer from the lack of comparability of today. Whether they are practitioners, they know exactly what they do, why they do it, what they would like, or whatever. So I think we are just on the verge of being in contact with people that can provide a wealth of very relevant information to solving this lack of comparability issue, and whether that is when that information is to be available, whether it's in a separate project or a next project too, or included, I don't know. It's a decision to be made. But I would really support that we do something.
I'm out.
Thanks, Sans. I think it's just additional comments because I'm supportive of the direction and suggestions in here. Two issues only that I think was mentioned by Daryl and Martin is terminology. To me, terminology is very important. It's very can be confusing, and there are loads of new terminology in this project. And I really like when you present in chart two, in between interest revenue and interest expense, DRM, derivative contribution. And then I'm just guessing we are going to use throughout the paper aligned portion to represent DRM contribution. I prefer personally the longer version, DRM, derivative contribution, instead of aligned portion in general. I think it represents clearly then aligned portion what we are trying to portray. So terminology, I agree with the perception. I wouldn't say suggestion at this stage. The perception that this could be a good occasion, good opportunity for us to explore the presentation. Just would like to hear from staff about timing, because we've been working on this for quite some time, and I was expecting for us to start sooner than later the outreach. We could outreach, doing an open outreach, like exploring how banks are presenting, and then try to gather more information to form eventually a basis to assess more thoroughly the issue. But I'm really, if this is not going to impact significantly the project, I think it could be a good idea. I think Francois expressed it. And then comes to Mary's comments on PFS. I at the end of the day, I was, because she of course naturally mentioned a project that we discussed just this morning. Morning, right? Yeah. Morning. Just the morning about the presentation in for financial intermediaries, I would call. And so this is, of course, is one of the key components of financial intermediaries. So, but Mary made the comment, but I felt at the end I didn't hear, so what? What would be the suggestion then? We leave these to the PFS, so we integrate these and then feed the PFS on this aspect while we consult. So it's somewhat where we are.
I'll come back to the PFS thing. Regarding what we are planning to do as outreach, Amaro, that is a full discussion to be had, because we are doing outreach even before we have a discussion paper based on board decision to date. So I don't want to preempt that, but the idea is to test the model in the outreach, not to do a blank check, and that's why we did it this way. So that's something we will get feedback on. Now, I think one thing, just to come back to what is the outreach and what is the user reaction to this kind of a presentation, although it was in the context of a different model, it's not very different from what we had proposed under the PRA. And that was something which did get positive user feedback. That was very clear. Regarding the PFS thing, means we are looking at this presentation here. It's a separate line item we are proposing as we are looking at. And one of the arguments which we put out, 9 already requires it. If you have a net position, you can't present it in any of the other lines. You have to present it separately.
It's not required to be on the face of the
line. No, it doesn't require it to be on the face. It has to be in a separate line. So, I'm not sure about that. Just give me a second.
I think as far as the PFS project is concerned, I think the proposals that are in this paper are broadly consistent with the proposals that we're going out with on PFS, so I don't see a conflict there. I think potentially as part of the discussion paper, it might be nice to have a section that sort of acknowledges that fact, but obviously the PFS proposals aren't finalised yet, so it's just a matter of providing people with that information, I think.
Separate line item in the statement of profit or loss.
I was just going to go back to the first part of Francois's comments, so not your comment about consulting on the presentation of interest revenue and interest expense, but rather you said something that made it sound like you thought the staff recommend. What I heard is an understanding of the staff recommendation being to combine the, using Amaro's words, DRM derivative contribution aligned portion with the hedge gain or loss from IFRS, the recycling of the hedge gain or loss from IFRS 9, and that's not what I read the proposal as suggesting. I read the staff proposal as saying this line that you see in chart 2 should be presented on the face of the P&L separately from interest revenue, interest expense, and implicitly from any other hedge activity that's being reported in the P&L. Is that what you meant?
You're right, because I said I supported the staff recommendation, and I indeed supported the variant thereof. Okay. To me, in the income statement, when you're going to have net interest income after hedging activities, not use margin. To me, I mean, this would have to reflect the result of whole interest rate hedging activities that the company has. I mean, otherwise, I don't know how many multiple lines we're going to have.
Is that assumption that you have about the subtotal or the line item? Because I think the subtotal, we're not, what we've heard from the staff is, while they phrase the recommendation in terms of subtotal, the revised question is not going to vote on the subtotal. So we aren't talking about the subtotal. We're just talking about whether or not this DRM derivative contribution aligned portion is required to be presented as a separate line item.
Yep.
Super.
And what Francoise is suggesting would be quite a big change in practice for micro-hedging.
That's the thing which I wanted to clarify, Francoise. We are saying the separate presentation for the interest DRM activities. The reason I think what is bringing it up, and so I also heard that, was that you also said that it should also include all interest rate hedges. Do you mean also micro hedges?
Yes, I did.
That would be a very big change. And more importantly, I don't think that would necessarily reflect what the economics of those hedges are.
And because certainly outside the scope of what's in this paper.
Yeah.
And also more.
No, that's for sure.
But that's one. But I don't want to do that without a paper, but I would also argue that that does not necessarily reflect what the economics of a micro hedge is. Because if you have a floating rate bond, which you have cash flow hedged into a fixed rate, your revenue from that is a fixed rate line, fixed rate. And that's what the recycling shows. I don't think I would suggest that we amend that, because that's not reflecting the economics of that hedge. And that's why the requirements are as they are. It's only for a net position you have to show it separately. And it's a big change.
So I was going to comment on a couple of things. Francois raised a good point, which I'd forgotten, which was it was actually a specific request of preparers that we focus on this issue as part of this project. But just say, but anyway. I think the other point is, assuming it sounds like people don't support my idea of getting the staff to do anything on net interest income at the moment, which is fine. But I think that when we do the outreach with investors, as when we've got the core model, I think we need to be very careful not to present it as though there's this lovely net interest income information that's available for the loan book, because it's not going to be the case based on the decisions we've made. there has to be a separate interest revenue line. There has to be a finance cost line. We don't require an interest expense line. We've got no idea what other interest revenue on other stuff they're putting in there or how they're calculating it. Basically, what we've achieved is you have to have a separate line for the effects of the dynamic risk management. You have to show the relationship between that and interest revenue and expense, but it's not as if there's this lovely net interest income that's definitely going to be provided that's going to focus in specifically on the hedging and the loan book. It could happen, but it's not what we're requiring of people.
So what, another way of putting it is to make clear what we are requiring, and also maybe one of the things that came out is ask them, because how important those metrics are and what they're seeing in practice before we start handling or getting into asking to specify what we should do.
Otherwise we're at risk of overselling what we're doing.
But my understanding is when we discuss in disclosure, then we have the target profile, we understanding, okay, what's it, maybe I would expect that we understand from this DRM book that we have an understanding what is the net interest income of that book. That is what we want to disclose. What we're currently discussing is on the face of the P&L. Exactly. If you have a bank which has a small book, which you have DRM, if they have maybe a big investment banking also, which have to be funding interest expenses for equity portfolios, the whole interest margin gives a total different picture compared to what we are doing in this project.
But I don't recollect.
And I think if we want to achieve that, it's not to be over, then I think that is a disclosure. What we want to achieve, okay, how good in this circumstances this book is risk managed. What we're currently discussing is, okay, on the face of the P&L, and I think, and I understood your proposal that we doing a project now to solve all these kind of problems, which I think is maybe we should do that, but I don't know if we should do it in this project.
I don't recall us voting on the requirement to present net interest income because it's not a defined term.
No, that is not what I said, but I think that is kind of what many banks doing and what we...
What we're asking them to do. They might choose to do it.
But, Sue, I think maybe the important point, I'd agree with Martin on this one, is because even if you are showing a net interest margin, absolutely, and you are in a DRM model, you're not necessarily in a DRM model for all of your interest-bearing assets and interest-bearing liabilities. So I think we need to be careful here of creating an assumption at any point that the interest margin is now going to look, is going to reflect perfectly the outcome of the DRM model. There's going to be a lot of other stuff in there, unless as another part of this, we require separate presentation of the interest income and interest expense
that is
subject to DRM process.
I think we've created the ability to have this nice, clean picture of net interest income. But I'm not sure we've made any decisions that mean that that's definitely going to be required to be shown somewhere.
I think quite the contrary. I think unless we actually have two interest income lines and two interest expense lines, you're never going to have a clean interest margin line.
Can I, just to clarify, I think there are two elements to what I'm hearing also. When we are talking about outreach, what to clarify is exactly the discussion we had, that if we show it what is there, it's not going to be your target profile, even if you're perfectly hedged on the face, because your book is much bigger than what's in the scope of DRM.
It can be.
It can be. And it can become all the more relevant if you go beyond the core model, because you can have equity model book there. And there it is a funding source which has nothing to do with interest income or expense. So we should clarify that. Certainly, we have never asked for a NIM disclosure, or now we're proposing. So what we have proposed here is a separate line item. The relationship to be shown, and what I'm gathering from Martin, that relationship, it's better to be in the disclosures rather than on the face. And what was the third bit? Sorry, Ross.
The third bit was, should we specifically consider this during outreach?
Yes, and that's Mary's point, what Mary said, that we
need to vote on that.
Yeah, we don't need to vote on that because we ask for everything. So these are the two points. Is that fair?
Okay, let's try to speed up a little bit, Tom.
Just to clarify for me, if you're hedging successfully, you're going to decrease the volatility in some income measure, presuming it picks up both the hedged and the hedging item.
Yes.
Okay. So when we do this, you want to make sure that you bring in the effectiveness of the hedge in this measure of income.
Yes.
And in the primary financial statements, we've created some useful subtotals. Mm-hmm. And I think what's happening here is if we bring in the line item as you recommend, it will decrease the volatility in any income measure that's got both the sides of it, right? The hedge. And so that making sure that line item is there for those profit items below is a good thing. I guess if I understand what Sue was saying, is a really common focused on thing is this net interest income thing, which would be sort of like a special subtotal. And I think some of the discussion is to actually get both the items into that special subtotal. So you're basically sort of a question about how many subtotals do you take the volatility out of? And I was trying to put it generically because I'm trying to understand what's most useful to the users ultimately, and is it you know which subtotals do we want to capture? And I'm a little bit sympathetic to what Sue said, is that if they look at this net interest income one, and we don't get it in there, you know, how helpful is that?
So I appreciate it, Tom. The other point is that we don't define that subtotal today.
Yeah, no, I know we don't. Yeah.
But that's, secondly,
that's why I was kind of linking to the PFS, because we're talking about creating new subtotals and management being allowed to stub in, you know, that, so we're in a kind of a moving world on these subtotals.
And the other thing is that even if we created a perfect subtotal on the face, it does not necessarily mean it will represent the entire NIM of the bank or net interest income of the bank, because there will be under DRM activities, because there'll be other activities, for example, funding of the trading book, on which there'll be interest expense, which will not be within this model.
Okay. Francoise?
Well, if I suggested that we would collect information, yeah, and not develop any further, first of all, because we are at the level of a core model, and we've taken the very easy assumption that we would consider as part of the banking book only those that are at amortized cost. And to me, it's likely that it's not going to be the end story.
No, it won't.
In this project, so the population anyway, maybe that's what they're all hinted to,
yeah,
with the various lines that would be needed. But it's not to discourage from
getting yeah,
all the input necessary in order to work ahead.
Absolutely. Don't disagree, Francois. That's what I'm saying. The scope will change this. That's why I was keep talking about the equity model book. As soon as you bring that in, that scope changes.
Mary?
Just on this issue of how much, if any, work do we do about the net interest income subtotal in the context of this project. I think Sue was right when she said she hasn't heard a lot of enthusiasm, but I think the messages I would take are do not do anything that would slow down getting the core model complete and getting out to consult on it. But when we're going out to consult with people about the core model, that is a good opportunity to ask them about whether they're preparer, whether they're user, about how important, if at all, is the typically used metric of net interest income that is relevant, and not doing any work before that, but just asking them about it. And by virtue of asking them about it, we will have a stream of info that we can then feed in to a paper that looks at the question of how much, if anything, should we try and do about that subtotal when we are moving from the core model to the full model.
All right. So supports the staff recommendation.
Question four. So can we repeat the question?
Just to make sure we're clear on the questions that we're asking, I think we're asking two questions. That the aligned portion, the ERM contribution, named to be decided later, should have its own line item on the face of the income statements. And that line item should be communicated in a way that makes it clear it is related to interest revenue and expense. And those are the only two questions we're asking.
Okay, 13 one absent.
Okay, go to the misalignment.
So moving on to misalignments, as everyone I'm sure is really keen to talk about this point.
So we have very similar questions as on this as we did on the aligned portion. We discussed this in paragraphs 46 through 65 and comment that there's information content to be communicated regarding the misaligned portion and that there's value to disaggregating the misaligned portions into the current and future period impacts. Here we consider if the misaligned portion should be also clearly linked to interest revenue, interest expense, or the aligned portion, and whether or not it should have its own line item or lines in the statement of profit or loss. We discuss in paragraphs 55 through 65, the misaligned portion should not be commingled with the aligned portion because the staff think this would not provide useful information to users of financial reporting. It would not adequately delineate between misalignment and alignment. The staff discussed the potential for a separate line item or two separate line items in paragraphs 62 through 65 and highlight that since disclosures are required to communicate misalignment when the lower test applies, the staff do not think the model should also require a separate line item given disclosures are required anyways. However, the disclosures must specify the line item where the amounts, if any, are included. And so with that, I'd ask the board if they agree with the recommendations on misalignment and more specifically, that the information about misalignment should be communicated in a way that makes it clear it is not related to the aligned portion, and that the disaggregated details of misalignment be separately communicated through disclosure, and that disclosure must specify the line item where the amounts are included.
I agree on both questions, but on the question number 7, is approach 3, I would not agree that we should require a separate disclosure.
Of the disaggregated bit.
Of the disaggregated, so not in the PN, not in the present, not the presentation, separate line item, so it is not, but also not asking for separate disclosure because I don't think there's a lot of information value in that.
No, fair enough. It's also fair, Martin, because we haven't brought the details of the disclosure for you, what the disaggregation will be. So,
yeah, but in approach 3, you said, okay, you were.
We did say that.
Mary?
I think I'm similar place to Martin. I agree that, we were just trained this morning that we can't say things would be misleading because we don't define misleading in IFRS standards. But I think we have to say that you cannot present the misaligned portion as in the same way that you present the aligned portion because otherwise you'd lose the information value of everything we've just set out to do. And in terms of, in terms of question 7, I think it was useful to understand the different information content that one could draw from the two portions of the change in the misaligned piece. But just because it's interesting and you could draw something, I don't want to go out and start presuming that we're going to even have a preference to requiring disclosure in the notes of the disaggregated piece. I think it would be fair if we are talking to users when we are consulting about the core model to say, is this something you are dying to get your hands on, and how would you use it, and you know how high would you put it in your list of priorities? But I wouldn't go out with a presumption of preference that we were going to require separate disclosure in the notes of on a disaggregated basis.
Okay.
Daryl.
So I sort of a mixed view on this one. I agree it should not be part of the interest rate margin. It shouldn't be in whatever inside that right terminology is. I think it should be separately presented in the income statement. And I think the background to my thinking is I think, and I understand the point about the misrepresentation of a zero number saying I've got a perfectly effective hedge. But I think anything that appears in the income statement has two purposes. The one purpose is to tell you whether it's a good or bad strategy, and clearly I can't tell you that. But the other part is to tell you how much it contributed to the bottom line. And I think these numbers can sometimes be quite significant. So if, and I think in the example, you've got 31.3 as your number. If that number is very material in the bottom line reckoning, then understanding how you've gotten to that bottom line is important. And I think the problem with leaving it as something that will just be subsumed into a different number is the number that it might be subsumed into may well be assumed to be a number that is part of the entity's normal activities as opposed to something that's part of the entity's not necessarily successful activities. Yeah. And so it just concerned me from that perspective. So my view is that I would say I think this should be a separately disclosed number, again, assuming that, a separately presented number, assuming that it is material.
Councillor Bowser.
I agree with Daryl, and he has explained my view much better than I would.
I agree. It should be presented as part of net interest income.
Should be.
Shouldn't. I'm slightly concerned with the presentation or disclosure of misalignment for under hedging. Remember, this is a conceptual amount. It's an opportunity cost. It's not actually a monetary amount. And I think we have to present that very carefully.
The under
hedging, yeah.
Which is essentially zero in the profit and loss.
It's nothing.
Okay, in profit and loss. And then just in terms, the other element then of misalignment, I would be very careful in presenting it in on the face, because if you've got multiple strategies, you've got some gross and netting effects going on, and an aggregated number can hide all kinds of things. And so I'm not sure.
And I don't think there's any suggestion that you would not then need to disclose more information in the disclosure part. It's just if this is a significant number that is changing your profit and loss for the period, changing your operating profit for the period, then it seems to me that this is a number that I think we know is likely to be quite volatile, then having that separate presentation as a number that you can understand as you work to the bottom line is, I think, what I was saying.
I guess it's the information you're seeking to get out of that number, if it's a measure of whether you've been successful or not in your hedging strategy. I'm not sure.
Well, I think it's probably, for me, it's more how much has it changed? Because, I mean, this is essentially, misalignment is essentially the unsuccessful part.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an unsuccessful number that can cause me to make a bigger profit or a bigger loss, depending on how this has played out. And it seems to me that's material to me understanding, call it the sustainability of my profit going forward. And I think that would have been my thinking. And the under-hedging, as I say, will never affect your profit and loss by definition.
Yeah.
It means that's always naught. Mm-hmm. And it's these two indications. How big an effect have I had on my bottom line for a number that arguably I'm saying is unsustainable, in the first instance, and then naught always has naught effect, so that's... I don't see it as a success indicator. I think that is an important
thing. No, we are not.
But I do see it as a contributor.
But again, Daryl, it's the first time also with a separate presentation on the face or not. It's a matter of emphasis and where you put it. We are not saying it will be hidden anyway. Agree with Nick that when we come with disclosure, we have to be careful about under-hedging. We'll cover that. So what we are proposing is that the notes is good enough for this one. That's right.
Can we vote on both questions?
Yep.
Yeah.
No, because I'm going to have different views on 6 and 7.
So, no, each separately. We need to take a break.
Question 6 then first.
Question 6, that the information about misalignment should be communicated in a way that makes it clear it is not related to the aligned portion.
Yep.
So that's 13.
13.
One absent. And secondly, that the disaggregated details of misalignment be separately communicated through disclosure that must specify the line item where the amounts, if any, are included.
Not disaggregated.
Straight disaggregated?
Yeah. Or should we take a vote on disaggregated first?
Would be that vote?
That's what you're proposing, right?
Should it be split into the current and the...
So it should be not... First part was not part of NIM, as we said, net interest income.
That we voted.
Yep, that's a vote. The second part...
So the question as written was, should the disclosures be disaggregated? That was the question as written. And so probably we should vote on that.
Yes, we need to get a vote on that.
Should it be disaggregated?
In the disclosure, in the notes.
The disclosure.
Between current and future.
Yeah.
Who supports the staff recommendation?
Disaggregated.
Oh, what is
it? Okay, good.
So then should it be presented in the notes?
Disclosed in the notes. Is this question not better asked the other way around? Should it be required to be presented in the face of the... Because we're saying... I think everybody's saying here that the number should be identified either in the notes or the income statement.
Yes.
The question is, should we be required to put it on the face?
Yes.
And I think, at least, Francoise and I think it should be on the face.
That's a better question. So should the DRM model require that misalignment have a separate line item on the face of the income statement?
Two in favor.
Two in favor.
Three.
Three in favor.
Favor. One absent.
One absent.
And then I think you can ask your other question.
You have the other question.
Disclosed.
Should it be an unusual item?
And So then should misalignment then, should the details of misalignment be separately communicated through
details?
Disclosure?
No, should the amount.
Should the amount?
Yes.
Be separately communicated through disclosure?
Okay, so how many?
Sorry, 11, one absent.
11, one absent, okay. Okay, just one for clarity because there was a bit of confusion. IFRS 9B 6.1, 6.6, 15, and 16 do require a separate line item for net positions.
If there are offsetting
risk positions.
You are clarifying the discussion, the previous discussion.
Which was we weren't sure. It does require a separate line item.
Yeah.
Okay.
That brings us to the end.
Well, the thing that was checked.
Most important.
Very much.
Thank you.